from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of the Indianapolis Garden Club's Garden Walk.
And I'll talk with artist Martin Kuntz about his pop culture-inspired paintings.
And I'll chat with Jim Glass of the Indiana Division of Historic Preservation and Archaeology. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Indianapolis Garden Club is thankful for our beautiful spring weather. They're presenting their 17th annual Garden Walk, featuring five gardens and an optional luncheon on Wednesday, June 6th from 9 until 3 p.m. Sharon Gamble invited organizer Laura Harris in to learn more.
All right, before we talk about Garden Walk, I want to talk about you and gardening. How did you get the bug? Were you born with a green thumb, or something happen in your childhood?
I think both. I think I was born with a thumb, and something did happen in my childhood. My mother, at age 83, is still out in her garden every minute of every day, and I see myself just like her. So, yes, I've always been that way. I was on the garden walk myself about 10 years ago, and so now I'm on the other end of the equation. And, yes, I in fact, if you've looked at my calloused, grubby hands, fingers, you would see that I am a gardener.
Takes one to know one. And you've just made a strong case for gardening leading to longevity, too.
Well, I guess that's right. Nothing like staying active, being out in nature. I agree. It just feels like it would add to longevity.
It's one of the few activities that you can do from a very small child to as long as you can still bend and move and get out in the dirt.
I agree, and it's really encouraging now to see all the community garden projects that are incorporating school kids, young kids. I don't recall that back in my day. I don't recall kids being, maybe we didn't need to so much. Maybe we were just naturally more outside and more aware of nature, and now we need to force the matter a little bit more. But it's nice to see that it's happening.
Need to get people away from the technology
Absolutely.
A little bit more. There are things in gardening for which there is no app.
I don't know. Have you looked? I haven't checked.
If I could get a smartphone to do my weeding, I probably would.
But. You know, I love what I call the grunt work. Actually, I love the weeding, the edging, the digging of sod. The creativity is not my strong suit as much as just the day in, day out grunt.
There's something kind of meditative about it.
It's pretty therapeutic.
Yeah. And even if you just go do it for 15 minutes in an evening, it still helps. What is your particular specialty in your garden? You love perennials? Are you a shrubs and trees girl or what?
You know, we lived in a different kind of landscape a decade ago, and I was a perennial floral type. And then we changed to a simpler house and altogether different look. And the garden, my love of plants as it relates to my garden has really changed with that transition. And all of a sudden, I find I am less floral, more minimalist, more just green, more about the size of the leaves and the texture of the leaves and the repetition, more than just cramming it full of flowers.
That's something that I find when I talk with people who are gardeners. Gardens are never the same, I guess, because you're never the same. So even a garden that is, even if you stay in the same house with the same yard, the same garden, it's going to change up a little bit every year.
I agree. It's amazing how a gardener is never done. And not just, as you say, not just because he or she never accomplishes what he or she wants to, but your eye changes, and And then when something grows, all of a sudden, what has grown under it isn't subjected to the same conditions. And
right.
That's the thrill of it, I think, is that it's constantly changing.
Tell me about how the process. How are the gardens chosen for Garden Walk?
Well, we found this year it's an arduous process because there actually is so much to choose from in the Indianapolis area. And it's a delicate little dance to come up with four or five properties that are diverse and that are also in close proximity. And we hear about those gardens through friends of friends, and we look over walls and we drive around all around the city, and it's a fun but challenging process to get gardens that just, it's like a puzzle, to get gardens that present a good, well-rounded picture with a lot of diversity and that is something for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And then you have to get the gardeners to agree that their gardens are ready for prime time.
Then there's that. It is a huge undertaking for a gardener. I hope they're not rethinking their willingness from last fall. They're not, because we know they're not, because they're such an enthusiastic group. That's one of the things that attracted us to their gardens. It wasn't just the garden. It was their involvement, their attitude about it. But you're right. It's something, I mean, we hope it gives gardeners pause before they say yes, because if it's a quick yes, we wonder if they really understand the challenges, because who knows? I mean, look at this spring and the weather conditions that have resulted in such unpredictable blooming schedules, for example.
Right. And things blooming way early.
Exactly. You never know when the city's going to come up and tear your street for sewer work.
Sure.
And so it's something that really demands a lot of the gardeners, and we're so grateful for the ones that have said yes, because obviously, a garden walk doesn't happen without gardens.
Right, right. Can you tell us a little bit about the gardens or the gardeners or both?
I would love to. You know, thinking about these gardens, we realize my co-chairman and I would like to mention them, Polly Jameson and Susie Sams, awesome women with amazing powers of organization, great gardeners themselves. And the three of us have talked often about what unites these gardens, and they are unique, we think, from the standpoint of the fact that not only are the gardeners just uniformly enthusiastic about their spaces, inspired by their gardens, anxious to talk about all the plant materials and hardscape that are in their gardens. But these gardens are themselves, this group of five is a group full of a lot of contrast, because, for example, there's one space that's very rolling, very bucolic, mm-hmm. very natural, very historic. In fact, there's a 100-year-old barn on the property that garden walkers will be able to go through, and they'll enjoy that. It's a very cool structure. And so that contrasts with a diminutive property in a neighborhood. We call it a neighborhood jewel. Very creative. In fact, the owner is a landscaper, professional landscaper, and you can tell it's just chock full of individual creative little touches. It's just a jewel. It's perfect. And then there are two others that are fairly contrasting. One that is undulating, perennial, and annual borders, loaded with color, espaliered specimens. And that contrasts with another property that is very linear, geometric, clipped. It's a little reminiscent of the Daniel Kiley landscape at the Miller House in Columbus that a lot of people have seen recently. Not much floral material, but every bit as enticing as the one that is.
Sounds very sculptural.
It's very, that's the word I was looking for. It's very sculptural, and it's befitting the homes that are on the property. And then there's one that I'm not going to contrast with another garden, but it within itself has contrasting features. It's full of all kinds of interesting components, a koi pond, a large vegetable garden with big scarecrow, a six and a half foot hedge maze that was planted for the owners, by the owners, for their grandkids when their grandkids were little.
Oh.
And now the kids are not little, and neither is the maze. And people will enjoy working their way through that, we think, during the walk. So
be sure to count noses at the end of the day. Make sure everybody came out.
Exactly. Yeah.
There is... how many people generally come on Garden Walk?
We estimate 500 to 600 on the Garden Walk.
That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. And that's something else that that we applaud the owners for, is their willingness to have people come in and walk through their landscapes. And it can have an impact, of course, on the landscapes. Mm-hmm. But gardeners are very aware of being respectful.
Yeah. They look down before they take a step.
Absolutely.
How do you ensure that all several hundred people don't go to the same house at the same time? Is it self-guided, but do you try to break people into groups after the luncheon, or how does that work?
You know, we have never had the need to do that. It's sort of self-selects, it seems like, and people can go to any garden in any order. They can go back to a garden if they were especially intrigued by it. And you might think that everybody would go like a herd from one to the other,
sure,
to the next, and that we would have a problem with overcrowding, and it really seldom happens.
That's good.
It is good. It is good. We have a lunch at Woodstock in the middle of the day, mm-hmm, that some people avail themselves, buy the ticket for that as well, and avail themselves of that opportunity. That divides things up a little, because other people who don't go on the lunch use that as an opportunity to see some of the places that might be more crowded. It just has worked out really well over the now 17, this is our 17th year for it, and we've never seen the need to get more prescriptive about,
sure,
how it's organized.
Don't fix it if it's working.
That's right.
We'd be remiss if we didn't say that the money raised goes to not one but several good causes.
Many good causes get funds from this event, and we love the fact that gardeners not only get a lovely, inspiring day from the money that they put out for tickets, but they know that funds are going to go to civic improvement projects that probably they feel very strongly about themselves, and you're right, there are many organizations and projects that have received Garden Walk funds through the years. Most recently, we've supported Conner Prairie Wetlands Restoration. Ball Nurses Sunken Garden at Riley Hospital has been another recipient of Garden Walk funds. The Glick Cultural Trail and the Riverdale Restoration at Marion University. Idle Jorg Holiday Park, KIB. The Cafe Garden at the Public Library downtown, mm-hmm, also received benefit from the Garden Walk funds, and I could go on. It's we're very proud of the organizations that we've been able to support with these funds.
Sharon Gamble with Laura Harris of the Indianapolis Garden Club. Their 17th annual Garden Walk is Wednesday, June 6th from 9 a.m. until 3 p.m. It includes 5 gardens, and there's an optional luncheon at the Woodstock Club. Tickets are $35 for the tour, $60 for the tour plus luncheon, and the Indianapolis Garden Club invests the proceeds in projects around the city. You can learn more at igcgardenwalk.com. Again, IGC for Indianapolis Garden Club, igcgardenwalk.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Artist Martin Kuntz's paintings barely look like paintings at all. Instead, they resemble collages of bright imagery from pop culture, cartoon characters, logos, and ads that have been cut out from magazines and pasted on top of each other. But there's no cutting and pasting here. It's all created from oil paint. Travis DiNicola spoke with Martin about his work and upcoming solo show.
You have got your big one-man show through Primary Colors titled The Fun Machine Died coming up in June. I know you're thrilled about this, I'm sure.
I'm pretty excited, yeah.
It's been a couple months when I first, maybe the first time I saw your work, maybe it's been over a year or so. And I said, so tell me when you've got a one-man show coming up. And so,
sure,
here we are.
Yeah, it's probably been about a year.
So your work, The Fun Machine Died, let's start with that. That's an interesting title, and if you know your work, it kind of makes some sense, but for those listening on radio and can't see the postcard advertising this piece, tell me where the title comes from.
Sure, it's kind of, I was thinking, well, most of my imagery comes from childhood, so it's when you kind of look back and assess the imagery and things that you're exposed to as a child, they kind of become more weighted, and you can actually assess them and look at them from an adult perspective. And in a lot of ways, that kind of kills the fun.
So, I mean, Disney images, cartoon images, toy images, I mean, rainbows, I mean, all lots of popular culture.
Right. Yeah, I'm also a huge fan of horror movies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I will say, despite my mom's best efforts, one of my friends had Showtime, and as a child, I found out what happens on late night at Showtime and stuff like that. So, there's some controversial imagery, but it's kind of all...
A little edgy, some adult images.
A little bit, yeah.
But then also you've got, I know I've seen pieces of yours, like with Michael Jordan.
Sure, sure.
Some sports images as well. I mean, really a whole mix. I mean, and your work, describe your work for me, because it's a collage of a lot of different images brought together, very colorful.
Right.
What's the medium? What's the size?
Well, typically I tend to like to work... fairly large, at least 3 feet in one dimension. I think that's a guy thing. I don't know. My professors in college always told me that guys have to overcompensate and paint large. So maybe
big
that's
pieces.
It. I don't know. Yeah. Typically they're oil. Occasionally I'll use some acrylic underneath, but yeah, for the most part they're oil, and I try and overload the canvas with imagery, so they tend to take a long time. I'll spend up to 2 months. Up to 6 months, sometimes depending on size. So
now, is anything printed on the canvas and then brought out? It's. I mean, you're not using any silkscreen images. You're not using any transfers or anything. I mean, this is all being painted on. I mean, that's because I think. I mean, especially like in some of the reproductions that I've seen, you know, whether it's on a postcard or online or something. You know, the first thought is, okay, it's a lot of images taken that have, you know, been photoshopped on or something like that. But that's. I mean, and that's sort of, I think, the beauty of seeing your work in person is it's like, oh, this is actually all painted on.
Yeah, it takes a long time. That's one of the fun critiques I get is why paint it?
So
like,
why
are you
it?
A painter? It's, I mean, I can use Photoshop, but the fun of it, I don't sketch. I don't have really any preliminary drawings going into a painting.
Really?
Yeah. My sketchbook's pretty blank. I think I have one, and I've had it for like 4 years. I have an idea in mind, a theme, and then a lot of times what will happen is I'll just kind of start with a couple images, hunt for more images, and kind of let the painting develop. It's fun for me because I don't know quite exactly how it's going to end.
And so really using the canvas itself as a way of experimenting and layering and adding on. Because I guess I kind of assumed that you did use at least Photoshop in some way to, in a sense, sketch out what your image was going to be. So not at all.
No, not at all.
Wow. Okay. So that being said, then, because these images are so layered and constructed with so much going on, there's got to be a lot of surprises for you then in the process.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's kind of freeing because I can put something in a left corner and say, I'm not quite sure if I like that. I can counterbalance it over on the right side. Mm-hmm. And play off images, you know, that definitely contrast each other. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's really nice to be able to work that way. When I was in school, I was doing...
Tell me about school for you.
Okay, I went to Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore.
Great program.
Yeah, I had a great time. I can't say anything bad about the school. But what I was studying up until pretty much my last year was very academic. Mm-hmm. Figures and interiors. And the fun for me in doing that was seeing how well I could paint and just... completing it, but I did typically work from photographs. Everything was pretty much roughed out as far as what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The end result was going to look more than likely, hopefully, like the photograph if I did a good job. And in doing that, I think I kind of realized this isn't really my work. Nothing about me is coming through. I love Caravaggio, but I'm not Caravaggio, so why am I trying to...
Yeah.
Paint like him.
So was it about your senior year when you started developing this style that's your style, or was it later? Or?
Yeah, it was,
I mean,
it was.
Was there something that brought that out, like a trigger?
I had a great professor named Tony Shore, and he would challenge me quite a bit, and I kind of wanted to challenge him and just do something that I didn't know what I was doing when I started. I had no idea. And I like G.I. Joes. I like Legos, and I like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and stuff like that. But I also, I love the Italian Renaissance and figure painting. So Looking at like James Rosenquist, Jeff Koons.
Sure.
They sort of found a way to mesh everything together. And so I kind of just wanted to, in a way, emulate that and use subject matter that was close to home and felt like me. So I did a painting that took me about 6 months. It was 6 feet by 2 feet, and I overloaded the canvas, and I never worked like that before, and I had no idea what I was doing, but it was fun.
And you
was,
look back, and I mean, similar style to
yeah,
what you do now?
Yeah. It really seemed to just make sense and click. Mm-hmm. So
what was the response at the time with your painting instructor?
It was great. He told me I wasn't a painter anymore. he told me I was an image maker, and I was okay with that. That was probably one of the best critiques I could have gotten. I didn't look at it like a bad way. It was sort of, I mean, I'm using paint, but...
Yeah, I mean, but you're an image maker with paint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
That's an interesting distinction. I mean, how do you see that being different from a painter? I mean, because you're pulling these other images together and...
I think it's more the way that I use paint. Mm-hmm. I guess if I were to... I don't know. I feel like Tony Shore would have wanted me to paint like Lucian Freud.
Okay.
And very, quote-unquote, painterly. And do figurative work and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But using so much flat imagery in cartoons, I think it just kind of... I don't think painters would call me a painter.
Yeah, and there, to be fair, I mean, your images are kind of flat. I mean, there's a lot of things that are, even though there's a lot of things piled on top of each other and brought together within the image, the overall canvas itself is somewhat, you know, flat. It doesn't have that
yeah.
same sense of dimension. Yeah,
sure. I think with so much going on, it flattens it out.
Yeah. So your show with Primary Colors. This, how did this come about for you? And again, this is going to be opening on June 1st through June 22nd at the Primary Colors Gallery down in the Murphy Building in Fountain Square.
Well, I had been working with them on their events committee. I helped out. I started last year volunteering for Art versus Art, which is going to be amazing this year. Please definitely do go check it out and check out Primary Colors. They do great things. And it was, I want to say, January or December of last year, January of this year, December of last year, and they just contacted me and said, we have a spot in June and we'd like you to show. So I've pretty much been trying to get everything together since then. And
so been making a lot of work specifically for the show? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's all along the same lines. This show will probably have about... I would say close to the last 2 years of my work, just because they take a really long time to complete, and there is so much going on in one painting. So,
excellent. Do you have I'm not even sure if maybe a favorite painting isn't the right question, but a favorite part of one of your images that that just really sort of, you know, I don't know, you kind of fell in love with or surprised you in some way?
Yeah, I always try and do new things. I think that's what keeps everything fresh for me. But I recently did a painting that will be in the show. The title of the painting is We Didn't Pay for HBO. and it's this iconic image of Anthony Hopkins from Silence of the Lambs. It's got great lighting in it. And it's kind of hard to describe the process, but I'll just, long story short there, it took 5,184 half-inch pieces of tape to complete it, and basically the overall...
Of tape? What type of tape?
Masking tape.
Yeah.
I'll try and keep this brief, but what I did was a black-and-white underpainting, covered the entire painting in tape, half-inch strips, and then scored it half-inch vertically, and removed them to create like kind of a digital camouflage or a pixelated effect.
Yeah, okay.
And then I sealed all that and then painted him on top. And then when I was done with him, I removed the pieces of tape that were underneath to show that black and white.
Huh.
So it gives like a white noise kind of effect to the image.
Yeah.
And it was really an insanely tedious process. I've done it in other paintings. But to build up that portrait that's 3 feet by 3 feet, really try and make it as just beautiful as I can, using a Grisaille technique of just layering and layering and layering oils. And then to peel off half the painting was like killing the painting. It was kind of, It turned out how I wanted it to turn out, but at the same time, I don't think I had painted something so well before.
Oh, man. Was that a tough process for you?
Yeah, it was.
Did you photograph it at least ahead of time? Or
I documented it all the way through, and I've had people say who have seen the pictures and had seen me working on it, you know, you need to show the painting. Just show a picture, you know, next to it of prior to, but I don't think I'm going to. I don't know. Maybe I'm battling with that. So
that's a tough call. I mean, because obviously, I mean, you've got the finished piece that you
wanted. Yeah, the end result is exactly what was supposed to happen. So,
but man, you had to have a lot of sort of faith that the process was going to work to be able to. I mean, essentially, you were risking destroying what you just said was one of the best paintings you made.
Yeah, yeah, having done the tape in that similar manner before, I knew what I was doing to an extent, but I didn't know, you know. You put these pieces of tape on, it's like, oh no, I started painting the eye and now I've just lost the pupil because there's tape under it that I'm going to have to peel off. And you kill pretty much most of the detail.
Did you have to go back and then repaint any detail that you lost?
I couldn't really just because it was half inch.
Then,
I mean, all I was working with were half inch squares. So.
Wow. I can't wait to see this piece.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And it's it makes sense with all the other work because, like I said, there are other sort of digital pixelated aspects to some of the paintings. So I think it fits and it has the pop culture reference, but at the same time, it's kind of a mix between that academic type of painting and something more modern. So
what's next on the horizon for you?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I'm definitely going to continue painting. I'm not going to abandon what I do aesthetically by any means, but I think finding a way to incorporate the figure back into the work a little bit more is something I really want to do. I'm working on a I'm working on a painting that'll be in the show of one of my buddies in his underwear. He's asleep, for to put it politically correct. But it's kind of the idea of dreams and subconscious. So he's the main focal point in the painting, but there are all kinds of cartoons and things around him sort of, I guess, attacking him, but not really. So that one definitely has a strong figurative aspect to it.
Travis DiNicola with painter Martin Kuntz. His one-man show, The Fun Machine Died, opens on June 1st at the Primary Colors Gallery in Fountain Square. That's on the second floor of the Murphy Building. For more information, visit primarycolors.org, and colors is spelled the British way, so it's primary, colours.org. Hey, Travis, you know what season it is?
It's starting to feel like summer, but still spring, Sharon.
It is prime microbrew season.
Oh, yes, it is.
What is that doing in the middle of an arts talk program? Well, I'll tell you on
sure
that calendar we call. What'll
we
do?
Or brew. There we go.
Actually, I have not one but two events that might involve an adult libation.
Well, why don't you start with those then?
Well, the first one is, I can't believe it's almost time for this again, but in just under a month, it's time for Scavenge the Avenue, presented this year by Nuvo, benefiting Indie Reads. It's a 6-block scavenger hunt coming up on Wednesday, June 13th from 6 to 9 p.m. Now, it's not a race. The idea is to collect all the clues and solve all the mysteries, but as I understand it, and you can fill us in on this, but you don't necessarily have to be the first to finish.
That's correct. You just have to finish, and then once you do finish, you're entered to win fabulous prizes.
Oh, I like that.
Many businesses up and down Mass Ave.
And the point is that a lot of those businesses feature nice cold things to drink.
Oh, that's true. That is
so
part of it.
You might want to gather your team, and you can be a one-person team, or you can have a 2-, 3-, or 4-person team.
Sure.
And it's more fun with friends, so you can go solve some clues and go sit outside at the Chatterbox, go solve some clues, and then go on down to our bistro. I mean, you can
just
make
work
your
way
own
up and
course.
Down.
Exactly. Oh, that's true. It's not that many blocks. You could do it 2 or 3 times. Anyway, find out more at indiereads.org. And on Wednesday, June 13th, you're going to be gathering at the Athenaeum. You're going to meet at the A. So indiereads.org. Scavenger Hunt, June 13th, 6 to 9 p.m., benefiting a great cause, Indy Reads.
And you've got something else that's brew-related.
I do. I want to remind people that the Indy Brew Bus is up and running. You can go Thursdays at 5:30, Fridays at 6, Saturdays at noon and 3:30, and Sundays at 1. Yes, they give you permission to have a beer on Sunday afternoon. It's a fun way to visit multiple craft breweries in Indy. They spend about 45 minutes at each location. You can order a pint of your favorite or get a growler to go, and they even have a way to keep your growlers cold on the bus. Each tour has room for 14 passengers, so think about doing that as, say, well, two of us have June birthdays coming up.
Sounds like a plan.
If any of our friends want to, like, organize a brew bus tour for one or both of us for our birthdays, I'm just saying.
There we go.
IndyBrewBus.com for more info on that one.
Hey, some dance events that are going on right now. In fact, this weekend, Gregory Hancock Dance Theater continues their behind the scenes with GHDT. It is their annual dance performance where they feature their pre-professional company. That's also known as G2. And this year, that company of nine dancers is going to be presenting pieces from Winter, from the Four Seasons, as well as a piece called Every Breath is a Prayer that deals with Tibetan Buddhism, and also a really cool one called Altered States that features music of Janis Joplin and The Doors and Cat Stevens. And lots of fun stuff. This is all part of their G2 in Concert, which continues this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And if you want to get more information, give them a call at 844-2660. The Saturday concert is at 7 p.m. and the Sunday concert at 2 p.m. up in Carmel, Gregory Hancock Dance Theater.
Fun. Hey, if you like dance, either you are a performer, you have performers in your life, children perhaps, or nieces, nephews, or you just like to be a spectator, you're invited to join the Indiana Ballet Conservatory, or the IBC, for the grand opening of its new studios. That's this Sunday from 2 to 4:30. The new studios are at 849 West Carmel Drive. Free admission. There'll be refreshments. You can tour the studios, observe a short performance by IBC students, and learn all about the conservatory's classroom work, preparatory and pre-professional dance training program, meet the faculty, and, tour the facility. There's a kitchenette and study lounge and dancer changing rooms, as well as, of course, the rehearsal facility itself. So that's all coming up this Sunday from 2 to 4:30. Find out more at IndianaBalletConservatory.org.
There we go. This is kind of fun. I just want to say it. Music for All and Bongo Boy Music School are launching a monthly community drum circle for downtown business professionals.
Yay,
that's right. If you
that's
just want...
what the world's been missing.
Exactly. So they are doing this. It's free of charge, and the first drum circle actually just took place the other day down at the Music for All office.
Is that
what that noise was. But they're going to keep on doing this every month on the third Wednesday of each month through the end of the year, and then who knows how much longer. Anyways, it's a whole lot of fun. If you want to know what this drum circle is about and to beat your drum downtown, then check out musicforall.org for more information.
And that's in the evening?
They're doing it at lunchtime, noon to 1.
Lunchtime? Mm-hmm.
Yep, at the Music for All office down at Jackson Place downtown, Union Station.
I say we should schedule our challenging meetings on Wednesday morning and then go out and... I did some voice work up at Bongo Boy Studios. They have a cool facility, and you cannot swing a cat without hitting an instrument. And don't worry, I don't actually
swing those cats.
Yeah. Fishers Arts Council is looking for artwork for their second annual, you ready for this? I Am Piano Play Me project. Artists are given the unique canvas of pianos, and their artwork will end up being public art. And there are 6 donated pianos that will be placed in public spaces in Fishers on June 1st. They'll be up until the Fishers Freedom Festival, and they'll be primed and moved to their outdoor location. The pianos will be painted as though it's a plein air painting event, so folks can come and watch people paint the pianos. Artists can work alone or in teams. There's no stipend, but materials will be provided, paintbrushes, paint, etc. Exterior latex paint must be used. Basic colors will be provided, and artists can mix hues. So this is all part of the Nickel Plate Arts Weekend, and you can find out more by emailing Lisa at Lisa at Gracie. gracycomm, that's C-O-M-M.com, lisa@gracycomm.com for more information. Who would not want to paint a piano? It sounds like a Marx Brothers
joke. That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Or an elephant in the piano or your pajamas or something. Hey, I want to give you a heads up to start planning for Taylor Martin's Indie Magic Monthly in June is going to have its 50th show.
Whoa.
I don't know if you can believe it. I remember when this first started, and it's fantastic.
And yet you're
that,
so young.
And well, and this is the theme, actually, for the 50th show. The theme is Barely Legal. They're all magicians between the ages of 15 and 23. So it's featuring some local magicians as well as some young magicians from Louisville and other parts of the Midwest, Illinois as well, and from New Albany, Indiana. Lots of great magicians. I'll be talking more about this in the coming weeks, but start putting that on your calendar now for June 5th at 7:30 at Theater on the Square. It's part of the Indie Magic Monthly series, and it will be their 50th show.
Woohoo!
Ta-da!
Ta-da! Wait, did you just make that press release disappear?
I did.
Uh-huh. Well, leave it to Jim Walker and his crazy colleagues over at Big Car. Outside the Box, which is a community arts program providing an atmosphere for all individuals to express, develop artistic skills, and discover new personal interests, they are featuring the art challenge called Outside the Shoebox. Art creations made from cardboard and shoeboxes. You're invited to create them and then see your work on display at Big Car on August 18th. You can deconstruct the boxes into pulp, furniture, jewelry, cardboard figures.
They do such fun stuff there.
Mechanical devices, so much more. Find out more by going to bigcargallery.org.
There you go. Hey, last thing I've got, Sharon, real quick, just a heads up that the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, is on their 35th anniversary tour. And if you want to check out this great band from New Orleans, again, the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, they are going to be playing at the Jazz Kitchen on Monday, May 28th. This is going to be a great show. It is going to sell out quickly to be able to check out this band in such a great venue. So definitely a heads up on that. Dirty Dozen Brass Band on the 28th at the Jazz Kitchen in Broad Ripple.
Where you can enjoy a cold beer. We will finish the calendar the way
it
we got
in. It all comes together.
We'll have more things you can see, do, drink, imbibe, whatever,
on
next
that calendar
week.
We call.
What will we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Sharon Gamble recently went to work for Indiana Landmarks, our state's largest historic preservation nonprofit. She wanted to learn more about what the various agencies that deal with preservation do and how they work together, so she invited Dr. Jim Glass into our Art of the Matter studios for a conversation. Jim Glass is the Division Director and Deputy State Historic Preservation Officer at Indiana's Division of Historic Preservation and Archaeology.
How did historic preservation call you into its service?
Well, I was a history major in college at Indiana Central College, which is now University of Indianapolis, and I was a history and Spanish double major, loved history, history is a passion, and I was got a job as a mayor's intern. Richard Lugar was mayor, and they loaned me out a part of my time to work for the American Institute of Architects local Indianapolis chapter to work on the research for a guidebook to Indianapolis architecture.
Really?
Which came out in the mid-70s, Indianapolis architecture.
So, I have that.
Yeah, that was sort of my introduction to history in the three dimensions, so to speak, architecture, and I enjoyed it. And the architects hired me back the second summer, and so by that time I'd sort of gotten hooked on historic buildings or learning more about them. And another year or so, I had an opportunity to go to work for the Indianapolis Historic Preservation Commission, which was just starting. This was back in 1975 to hire their staff, first staff. And was with them for 7 years, which was when the first historic districts, Lockerbie Square, the Old North Side, Fletcher Place, and Chatham Arch were just beginning. And so that was an interesting period to live through and to see the beginnings of people restoring buildings and moving into those areas.
I want to hear more about your personal history, but before we move on from that, were we
Was that something that was happening across the country? Were we late to that party? Were we an early adopter in identifying historic districts and trying to protect them?
I think it was sort of a national movement. It's sort of, there was a back to city movement in the early to mid 70s, young adults particularly moving back into the city because they liked the plus factors in old buildings. They liked living close to where they work. The ones that moved back in often were handy and wanted, could do the work themselves. And this was a national movement that really happened across the country in many cities. So I'd say Indianapolis was probably on par with many other cities around it. I remember some of the early residents in Lockerbie Square said that they had gotten at least one couple, I remember, the Kinleys, who still live in Lockerbie, had previously lived in German Village, which is a historic section of Columbus, Ohio. So mm-hmm. that had sort of predated Lockerbie a little bit in the 60s. But I'd say Indianapolis was very much in sync with a national movement.
It's so intriguing how the pendulum swings, because that same kind of movement is happening a lot, especially for people who are under 40 right now, who mm-hmm. maybe at some point grew up in the suburbs and they crave the connection of urban living.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, that does seem to be very much the case. But perhaps what people who are new to the city don't realize is this is a movement that's been happening for 40 years here. And the young adults of 40 years ago were very much like young adults today, craving that connection to the city and coming from the suburbs where they'd grown up to live in the city and sort of become urban pioneers.
Mm-hmm. So back to your personal history. So by this point, you're kind of hooked mm-hmm. and you decide to go back to school. What is the main difference between preservation as you went on to study it and history as you started out studying it?
Well, history, as I studied initially, and history in many history departments across the country, is sort of the study of history in two dimensions, the documents, the photographs, reconstructing the past through documents and records of the past, and then writing a history, a record of it. That's been history since Herodotus, you know, mm-hmm. 2,500 years ago. But historic preservation is sort of history in three dimensions. It's the places where people work and live over many generations that gain meaning and importance. And you can be in touch with the lives of people who lived previously in a place by being in an old building. And then there are the plus factors. People like the plus factors, the tall, you know, pre-1900 or pre-1920 houses, tall ceilings, plaster details, wood trim. Have been always been attractive factors, which are not available in newer houses.
Mm-hmm. So you ended up going to work at a statewide level at some point.
Yes, I went to graduate school at Cornell University in the 80s and got my MA and PhD in architectural history and historic preservation planning. And then I went to work for a large engineering firm in Greenbelt, Maryland for a couple years in historic preservation consulting. And then about 22 years ago, I got a job. My current job, I've had twice in 1990.
Recycling it. It's
yeah,
finest.
Exactly.
You're
right.
Very green.
Exactly, yes. So I did that for 4 years, and then I went to Ball State University for 13 and headed their graduate program in historic preservation, and then came back to this job in 2007.
Now, one of the questions I get asked most often. I recently went to work for Indiana Landmarks, which for its first 50 or so years was known as Historic Landmarks Foundation. The question that comes up all the time, and I'm going to ask you this question, how do we know something is worthy of being preserved?
Well, I think there's this national movement we talked about earlier has grown in great strength in the last 40 years. And so there are people who are fixing up and renovating houses and commercial buildings on main streets to work or live in all across the country. And whether they think of themselves as preservationists or they think of their buildings as historic, that in a way is preserving preserving the past, our heritage. And that has validity for those who engage in the exercise.
Mm-hmm.
If your question's about what do we consider historic, well, there's something called the National Register of Historic Places, which is a national listing maintained by the National Park Service in Washington of what is considered worthy of preservation. It's an incomplete list. Nominations are made every year to it across the country through state historic preservation offices like the one I'm involved with.
And that process is pretty rigorous. There's a lot
yes.
of research.
Yes. There is a sort of a documentation and a justification for meeting criteria for the National Register of the Park Service established. So one has to sort of make a case for how a building or property or a landscape or an archaeological site meets criteria important in events in our history or persons, broad events or trends, persons, architecture, art, or archaeological importance.
Being on the National Register, and I realize I'm asking you in a short radio interview to try to give a bird's eye view of something that is a deep and complex profession, but being on the National Register does not confer to a place any kind of protection, does it?
No, the listing in the National Register is an honor. It's a recognition of value and importance, but it doesn't impose any restrictions of any kind on property rights or what the owner may do. And that's a common misconception, which I guess I need to emphasize. There are benefits, though, of being on the National Register. If you are an owner of an income-producing building that's listed on the National Register, you can apply for federal historic rehabilitation tax credits. If you renovate your building, there's a 20% federal income tax credit you can take if you apply through our office and through the National Park Service. If you're a nonprofit or local government and you own a building on the National Register, we have a grants program through our office, which is the Division of Historic Preservation Archaeology, Indiana Department, in the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. A grants program for bricks and mortar restoration of buildings listed on the National Register that nonprofits and local governments own. So those are two benefits of being listed on the National Register.
So what are some of the other organizations that might aid or assist or advise someone who has an interest in something historic, be it a hotel, an old commercial building, a historic bridge or whatever? What are some of the agencies and how do they work together and how do people find out where they should go for help?
Well, it's really a collaborative, complementary kind of system at the national, state, and local level. In our state, we're in the state government, and we have programs, some of which I mentioned, to facilitate and help people who are involved in historic preservation, or, as I should say, involvement in protecting or investigating archaeological sites, which is part of our mission. But in the private sectors, there's Indiana Landmarks, which is the largest statewide nonprofit preservation organization in the country, which is very unusual. Most states do not have such a large private nonprofit, and they really are active at the grassroots level because they have 9 field regional offices across the state. So often people will talk to a staff person in Indiana Landmarks. Maybe it's their first point of contact because they maybe know them locally or they're in a nearby town. And they also use our programs and refer people to our programs, so we sort of do cross-referral. And then there are local preservation organizations in many cities and communities across the state. In Fort Wayne, for example, there's Arch Incorporated, which is a nonprofit. In the Lafayette area, there's a Wabash Valley Trust for Historic Preservation. So these are not at all unusual. Landmarks has been involved. I think at one point they had 144 local nonprofit preservation organizations recorded across the state, which is quite interesting. And the other thing is the local government. Indianapolis has an Indianapolis Historic Preservation Commission, which administers historic review over exterior alterations and changes in designated local historic areas here in Indianapolis. And there are preservation commissions, I think there's 35 or 36 across the state.
Wow. You've been involved in the field for a while. What are some of the big shifts you've seen in your years as a preservationist?
Well, I think you can see progress in many fields, and preservation is no difference, by looking back over a period of time. And I know people sometimes express frustration because they may not feel, people are involved in historic preservation, that there's a lot of progress being made today in a certain aspect. But if you look back over 35 years, it's amazing how much has been accomplished. And I see that in Indianapolis. Lockerbie Square, the Old North Side, Chatham Arch, they were really depressed neighborhoods with lots of demolition going on weekly. Very dilapidated buildings. They were places that no one really seemed to want to live in until this revitalization happened. And over the past 35 years, they're now some of the most desirable areas in the city with a very high quality of life.
So it takes some people to be pioneers, to be brave, to say, I think maybe this is worth saving.
Yes. Yes, and I think the other thing in Indianapolis is that historic preservation through the neighborhoods and this neighborhood revitalization and then developers in the 80s beginning to renovate some historic buildings downtown like the Omni Severn or Lockerbie Marketplace or Union Station. These folks really were pioneers in downtown revitalization because there were a few new pieces of construction going up, but they brought people downtown to live in these neighborhoods, and that also then acted as a catalyst, I think, for Massachusetts Avenue and Fountain Square and some other areas.
Sure. Favorite site in Indiana?
Oh, I can't choose. I have so many favorites.
All your children are beautiful and talented.
Exactly.
All right, one of your favorites.
Well, I think the eighth wonder of the world is in Indiana, which is the West Baden Springs Hotel. If anybody's not been there, they should go down there because it is a wonderful, wonderful building.
Why was it called that?
Well, it was for many years the largest self-supporting dome in the world, was what was the claim was. It's just an awe-inspiring interior space, 250-foot diameter atrium, which has been wonderfully restored by the Cook group and Cook family.
And built in 1901.
In a very short period of time, yes.
And if you think about the tools that we did and didn't have back then, it's kind of an engineering marvel.
It was an engineering marvel. And I think that's one thing that impresses people when they go there today. Yes, that's a wonderful place. The French Lick Springs Hotel, which is a mile away, is a place of great historical importance and ties Indianapolis through Tom Taggart, who was the mayor of Indianapolis, who built that hotel and made it a national center for politics and for conventions and spas.
How do you decide? Many of our listeners will be most familiar with you through your columns in the Indianapolis Star. How do you decide what you're going to write? Do you have a whole notebook full of ideas? This deserves a profile. This deserves some mention.
There's so much around us all across the state. Some columns are on Indianapolis. Some of them are around the state. Sometimes I'll take a trip and get ideas from people I meet. There's something I see in the newspaper or maybe through public radio I hear about that says, oh, that might be interesting to investigate. And it's interesting. I've been doing the column for 9.5 years, and there's still lots of new ideas and new possibilities out there.
Sharon Gamble with Dr. Jim Glass, Division Director and Deputy State Historic Preservation Officer at Indiana's Division of Historic Preservation and Archaeology. You might also recognize him from the regular essays on preservation that he writes for the Indianapolis Star.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 when I'll talk with visual artist Dan Cooper about a new performance art piece he's working on.
I'll find out how you produce opera on demand with the Intimate Opera.
And I'll get a preview of the Modus Dance Company's Pairings, Performance and Tasting. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.